We're used to newspapers spicing up their weekend editions with colour supplements, but why would a magazine want to launch another magazine? Plus, blockbuster titles from Paris and the United States, and a new food publication with a fresh take on veganism. All that ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Germany's Der Spiegel is one of the most august news weeklies on the continent. It's famed for its dogged investigative journalism and authoritative opinion setting, but it's less well known for lifestyle coverage. So why has it recently released a lifestyle supplement, S Magazine? And what does it mean for a magazine to release a magazine? To find out more, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan spoke to Der Spiegel's editor-in-chief, Klaus Brinkbaumer.
Well, I think we meaning Der Spiegel, we had left a gap open for a couple of years. Der Spiegel moved its publication date from Monday to Saturday 3 years ago, and it helped a lot in terms of finding the audience, which really has time to read over the weekend. So Der Spiegel is doing quite well these days, but on the weekend, people want to read entertaining things too. They want to read about literature, culture, design, all these topics, which Der Spiegel doesn't regularly cover. We are a political and business news magazine and doing investigative reporting, of course. And so all the pieces on style, design, fashion, they normally get cut because some investigative piece comes in. And which piece is going to win? Well, the investigative piece is winning, and the so-called lighter topics are always falling out of the regular news magazine. And now we have S.
And is S sold separately from Der Spiegel, or is it kind of contained within it?
It's contained within it. When you buy Der Spiegel, we have it on the cover as well. You know it's in there, but it's a supplement.
So one thing I'm interested in is that we're very used to newspapers having magazines, usually in the form of colour supplements. But Der Spiegel is itself a magazine. Were you at all concerned about there being some kind of weird cognitive dissonance about containing a magazine within another magazine?
We thought about that, and you're absolutely right, Henry. Normally, it's what newspapers do, especially the weekend editions. They have some kind of style magazine inside. And we do it the other way around. S is more like a newspaper because its format is bigger than a usual magazine. It's folded. So we have a magazine which contains a newspaper in there. So it's the other way around. And it, I think it's stylish. It looks good. And we did that, or we have already done that, with our literature supplement, which we started a year and a half ago. It's the same format. It's a similar design. And it's a newspaper within the magazine.
Maybe you can tell me a little bit about some of the specific stories that you've published in S Magazine so far and use them to illustrate what the magazine's really about.
There's always going to be one main cover topic, which for the first edition is home or homeland. Heimat is the German term. What is home? What is your homeland? What does it mean for artists, for designers, for us, for people who are, of course, obviously these days used to traveling so much, to being constantly moving, to driving far distances to get to their jobs? What does home mean these days? And that's the cover topic. And designers and artists and all kinds of creative people are giving their answers. There's fashion shootings in there. There's columns in there, culture and arts columns. So that's the concept.
And you mentioned that one of the reasons for starting S Magazine was the fact that so much good cultural content was being cut from Der Spiegel itself. Do the people who put together S Magazine, the journalists you use, are they the same kind of people who work for Der Spiegel? Do you use Der Spiegel staffers on S Magazine? How do you source talent to write for it?
Some of them are from our regular staff. Some of them are freelance writers and designers. And Johannes Erler, who designed the magazine, is not a staff member here. He's one of Germany's leading art directors. So we hired him to do this. He's a freelance art director. So it's both.
And I wonder, Germany is a country which is so rich with print innovation and there's such a great range of magazines. Where do you look within your own country for inspiration when you were launching S Magazine?
Well, we actually didn't. Of course, there's competition. There are the weekly newspapers like Die Zeit, for example. They have a very good magazine, which is a supplement magazine. Of course, we look at what they are doing. But in terms of what are we doing here, we didn't. We looked at magazines like Monocle. We look at the New York Times Magazine or T Magazine or publications in Great Britain and in the US. Not so much within Germany, to be honest.
And, you know, you mentioned that S Magazine followed hot on the heels of a literature supplement that was a separate supplement that you began that last year. In the future, do you want to expand or diversify the kind of separate sub-magazine offerings that you are going to offer readers? Or are you going to concentrate on just making S Magazine as good as it can be?
Of course, open to other supplements as well. We have to see how this one goes and how our advertising will be. Seems to be excellent with the first edition. There's lots of ads we didn't have before, but we'll see in the long run. And then, of course, I'm open to other innovations, and we're trying some things out right now. We're too early to talk about those, but yeah, we'll see.
Der Spiegel's editor-in-chief, Klaus Brinkbaumer, in conversation with the Stack's Henry Rees-Sheridan.
Download Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Amit Chowdhury. The Indian-born author is also a poet, a critic, and a musician. He's won some major awards for his work, and his seventh novel, Friend of My Youth, is, he says, not really a novel at all. We discuss literary forms as well as his background in Bombay and Calcutta. That's Amit Chowdhury on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
Time now for a short hop from Germany over the border into France. Parry Match somewhat preempted Der Spiegel's release of S Magazine. It's been combining serious political reporting with softer lifestyle content for decades. At the FIP media conference earlier this month, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Parry Match's editor Olivier Royon to discuss, among other things, how the Macrons can boost sales.
Let's talk a little bit about Parry Match. It's such, in my opinion at least, a unique combination of hard news stories, you know, a couple of celebrity stories. Is, you know, for example, in the UK, I can't see a British Paris Match. You know, is that what you want, to have a unique magazine in some ways?
Oh, it's absolutely unique. I mean, everybody was trying to do it. Some Tina Brown tried to duplicate the Parry Match in the United States. It didn't work. I think it goes back to the talent of the pioneers when they created Parry Match in 1949 after the war. Suddenly, you have the thing that France was in bad mood after the war, people were poor, they need to see some light. And at this point, these journalists, they haven't been to universities. I mean, they were people, very pragmatic people, but they enjoy life and they were so curious about life that they decided that they would create a very visual magazine, a very modern, very lively magazine. And this magazine would give you the right to get interested in everything. If you're a woman, you could be interested in war. If you're a man, you could be interested in fashion. And that's a very modern promise that we try to keep 70 years later.
And what about, you know, this perennial question about kind of digital print? I presume you're still big believers in print because, you know, I think it's a nice magazine to have with you. But do you invest in digital as well quite a lot? So what's your strategy?
We are, I came from the print generation and I enjoy doing the magazine, editing the magazine every week. What I would say that at the same time, so we are exploring and we are introducing the magazine to the brand, to a new generation and new audiences, which is a fantastic opportunity because we have the capacity now to bring this brand to people who had never heard about us before. What we are doing, I mean, for years we have been concentrating on preparing the big paella once a week. Now, we have to make tapas all day long, feeding people with small bits of news. We still have the big paella on Thursday morning when we hit the newsstands. At the same time, we are working on small pieces of journalism every moment of the day. And you know what? You have to tailor these stories very differently from one platform to another. We have to adapt to this 24 hours news cycle, which is absolutely quite vertiginous. I mean, it's quite frightening to see the speed of this cycle. But we have to produce this article, these stories. And what we enjoy doing these days is that we believe that the visual storytelling is very important. For example, the linear storytelling is important. In print, you deal with your eyes, you deal with your brain. On mobile device, you deal with your eyes, your brain, and with your fingers. And people want to tap, they want to touch, and something has to happen. So, for example, on the Discover platform, Discover with Snapchat, when our readers, they are from 15 to 25, when they tap something, suddenly Beyoncé starts singing, or they tap and you get little hearts flying on the screen. I mean, these are very different ways to present the stories. But we didn't compromise with our values. I mean, this is journalism. I mean, everything that people will read on every single platform of Paris Match will be true. Our business is to tell stories, but it's to tell the truth.
Something that I'm very curious about the magazine, especially after Macron's election, is that, you know, they are quite a fascinating couple. So do you think in some ways the fact they win, it was actually quite good for Paris Match, because the French are very interested, not only the French, I would say, I think even people from abroad as well. So, for example, when you put Brigitte on the cover, does the sales go up a little bit? Or
when we first put Brigitte on the cover, that was a year and a half ago, suddenly something happened. We sold 60,000 copies more than the week before. So what's going on? We tried to find out what was going on, and actually what we discovered that there was some kind of relationship of curiosity that was being built between the French public and this couple. Who are they? And at that time, it was April 2016. At that time, people were trying to find something authentic in this couple. They were curious, and they started liking them. And the age difference, the big love, they were like this romantic and out of a novel couple. And this is the moment where Paris Match enter, because we like great stories like this. And we start doing one cover, two covers, and then people were more and more curious about the Macron history and the couple. So it's always important for the magazines, I think, to bring new characters. We want to be a media of our times, so we need to have the people from our times. We need Pharrell Williams, we need the actors, we need the great stories, and we need new politicians. I mean, we need Justin Trudeau, we need Macron in France, we need Donald Trump. I mean, all these people, they are in the news and we have to cover them. But there was, yes, there was a phenomenon with Macron who has a quite photogenic or so. I mean, it helps. It's not an old, grumpy politician that we are putting on the cover.
That was Olivier Royon, editor-in-chief of Paris Match, in conversation with the Stack's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Over the course of its nearly 130-year history, National Geographic magazine has evolved from being a rather esoteric scholarly journal, the in-house publication of the National Geographic Society, of course, to one of the most popular and cherished magazines in the world. Of course, there are unique challenges to publishing a magazine in 65 countries and almost 40 languages. To find out more, Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently spoke to Yulia Boyle, Senior Vice President at National Geographic Partners International Media Group.
Yulia, pleasure talking to you, especially because National Geographic is such an iconic publication. And I wonder, being such an iconic publication must be hard as well to maintain and to expand, but perhaps not too much to not lose, you know, the soul of the brand in a way. What do you think about that?
I think it's very important to focus, and we are focusing. We're not going beyond our core competencies. We are a cause-driven media brand. We cover exploration, adventure, science, and do that all with arrestingly visual photography. So this is our core belief, and this is the core competency we have. So no matter where we extend, we keep those principles with us and those values to serve the passionate communities that trust us with our authoritative voice in those subjects.
And I love what you just said here in your panel, that you want to make the brand premium, you know, so if somebody goes and buy the title or any other products, you know, it needs to be special. Tell us a bit more about your belief in that premiumification.
Yeah, I think since we are, you know, bombarded with so much information, and there's this avalanche of stuff coming at us, news and videos and, you know, social, I think we do have to have a focus, and I think we have to invest deeply in the journalism in order to make sure that we don't give the time of the day, as I said, to the fake news. And in order to do that, you have to occupy this premium position, because your issue has to be on a, if you define it as a print edition for a moment, it has to look great, it has to be on a higher grade paper, it has to be glossier, because it's unique. You have to make it unique for the audiences to come to you and choose it over so many different other things that are available.
Does the brand still, I'm sure you still believe in print, but are you still kind of launching new titles? Do you still, you see a market there still?
We are definitely launching new titles, as I said, going deeper into our special interest verticals, launching History magazine in US 2 years ago, and we're launching Science magazine very soon. We're also launching Food magazine, in fact, in UK. But of course, this is just a part of our portfolio. We are a very large television company through the joint venture with National Geographic Society. We formed Edgeo Partners, which is a merger with 21st Century Fox. So TV is 80% of our business. So we reach people through long-form television. Short-form video is a very important part for us to engage with our audiences. And we're on social, of course. We, for example, are considered to be number one non-celebrity brand on Instagram right now. It's huge. We're, you know, up there with celebrities. So a lot of people care about passion of exploration, photography, and storytelling. So I think as long as we do it well, as long as we invest in the storytelling, we are going to be needed.
And finally, Julia, I know National Geographic is very international. Coming back to books, magazines, how do you deal? Because I wonder how many countries have a National Geographic. Do you have to cater for the people in that country? So do you tell us, how does it work?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. It's a very big part of our strategy. For magazines, we are in over 70 countries around the world. We do that through our licensing partnerships. So we have over 140 licensees around the world. And the magazine, the iconic Yellow Border magazine, is in 36 languages right now. We also have 19 editions of Traveler. We have 18 editions of Kids magazine, 5 issues of History. We sold 5 million books last year in local languages, units that we sold across the world in 38 languages. So our partners are inspiration. We are relying on them to provide localized content within the ecosystem of National Geographic. Of course, we provide the bulk of the content, but localizations are anywhere from 0 to 50% in our magazines. And of course, we have television that is in over, you know, 140 countries around the world that's accessible through free-to-air and paid television.
That was Julia Boyle, Senior Vice President at National Geographic Partners International Media Group, talking to Fernando. Finally on today's programme, while foodie magazines abound on newsstands, few of them cater specifically to vegan tastes. That's the aim of Om Nom, a magazine that carries the tagline, "Eat more greens." With its subtle design and eclectic collection of interviews, essays and recipes, it eschews zealousness to take a refreshingly light-footed approach to extolling a vegan lifestyle. Glad to hear it. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan spoke to the magazine's editor, Helena Murphy, and designer Ben McCabe to find out more.
It's about trying to make people think a little bit more about what they eat and what they put on their plates. So originally, we both wanted to do a travel magazine. We were sat in a cafe one day and realised that the magazine we wanted to make was absolutely just been made by somebody else. So
I won't ask you to name names.
No.
Okay.
But basically, yeah, so we sat down and I said to Helena that what I definitely don't want to do is make a food magazine, because food magazines are boring, they're, you know, they're this, that, the other, they're trite, they're not what I like to read. 2 hours later, we had an idea for a magazine that would, in our mind, kind of change the dynamic a little bit. The big thing for us was that kind of a lot of sort of veggie vegan publications are very, they're either very green and very eco-warrior-ish, or they're very kind of minimalist, you know, quite fashionista style. We wanted to do something that was a bit more inviting to kind of a broader audience, that kind of welcome people into the discussion rather than it being very much, you know, shouting, you need to eat in a certain way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you who this publication is aimed at, because, you know, as you mentioned, I think a lot of organisations which advocate for vegan or vegetarian lifestyles
can be preachy or shaming in their tone. But Om Nom is really warm. It feels very inviting. It's not carping at all. Is it meant to be reaching out to people who, you know, may have an interest in what they eat, but, you know, haven't necessarily dived headfirst into the vegan lifestyle so far?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely kind of created it with like a very warm, welcoming approach in mind. We kind of wanted to reach people who, although vegans and vegetarians, we do expect them and want them to be part of our core audience. We are kind of reaching out to people who are maybe looking at a flexitarian diet or are perhaps looking at reducing their meat intake or who are just a bit curious about eating more veg, because I feel like that is the way that everyone is kind of going right now, which is really positive and really encouraging to see. But we also kind of wanted to keep in mind that we wanted to approach a very gender-neutral audience. We wanted it to be for both men and women, whereas we feel a lot of the publications so far have been quite sort of female-focused or oriented.
Why do you think that is? A lot of the publications that deal with a vegan and vegetarian lifestyle, right?
Yeah.
Why do you think?
I'm not really sure. Like, it's kind of something that we've maybe come across a bit in real life ourselves, because maybe some people, when we're eating out, kind of give Ben a look as if to say he's only vegan because I am, which is really not true, and it kind of undermines his decision.
It's actually something that we raise in the magazine. One of the articles we write is about masculinity and vegetarianism and veganism, and I was lucky enough to get hold of four different people all across the world to talk about kind of their experiences with going vegetarian or going vegan as a guy, and kind of the way that society looks at it. There were some really, really interesting kind of responses on how, you know, one of them doesn't really talk about it in public because he knows that all of his friends aren't going to take it well. Another one ended up meeting a guy at university who was vegan, laughing at him and then actually speaking to him about it and then slowly being converted as it went through. I do think that, you know, a lot of men in particular are kind of put off by what they see on Instagram or what they see kind of being put around socially, and they see it as they're not part of and they're not involved in. And I think it's a real shame because there's some really brilliant food kind of related stuff going in around vegetarianism, veganism. And there's some brilliant guys and girls kind of doing different things with it. So I just feel like it's something that a lot of magazines have maybe done with the idea of, oh, on Instagram it looks like it's a female thing, so therefore we're going to ape what it looks like on Instagram. And I don't think it needs to be like that at all.
Yeah, so, you know, you just mentioned there that you wrote an article about veganism and masculinity, and I feel that's really indicative of the eclecticism of the magazine. It's not just about the food. It's not just nice pictures of food. You do have them. You have recipes, but you also have a profile of a London brewery. You have a profile on emissions and how that ties into people's dietary choices. How did you decide what to cover in this magazine? How did you delineate its scope? Because I suppose once you've stepped out of the kind of just taking pictures of nice food box, you could kind of, it's difficult to know when to stop.
It is. A lot of it came down to what inspired us as we kind of took the journey towards kind of more ethical eating. One of the kind of interesting things about it was that I wasn't actually vegan when we started making the publication. And at that point, I still thought that ethical meat was, you know, something that we should be investigating and writing about. And I actually started writing an article about that and realised that I couldn't justify it and ended up writing about something different instead. But that kind of informed a lot of this first issue. It was very much kind of what inspired us rather than a kind of a curated, we want it to be on a certain theme or that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think with our next issue, we kind of want to branch into more about lifestyle. So this issue has been very heavily focused on food. And while we're not shifting that at all, it's still going to be a food magazine. We want to cover a lot of issues that we've kind of unearthed while writing this issue. So one of them has been plastic wastage and how extraordinarily difficult that is. How do you go about living a plastic-free life when even your toothbrush is made out of plastic? So that's something that we're going to be looking at in issue two.
There are so many successful food blogs and Instagrams out there. It would be a lot easier and cheaper to make one of them than carry on making this magazine. Why print?
It's more about what we're trying to do with the magazine rather than kind of what we're trying to do with the brand. We spent most of our money on the quality of the stock for the magazine itself. We wanted this to be that something that people would buy and they'd keep on their coffee tables for 6 months a year, and that, you know, at Christmas or whatever, somebody would pick it up and find their preconceptions challenged. We want this to be something a bit more lasting than an article that goes up on a blog and then 2 days later nobody looks at it again, unless, you know, it resurfaces on Pinterest or something like that. We do online articles, you know, it's mostly recipes, but there is definitely a place for that. But I think also There's also a place for something a bit more long form, in depth, where you're really getting into the issues that are the issues and the opportunities that are out there for eating more ethically.
I feel like the noise on social media can be a bit exhausting sometimes as well. And while I love social as much as anyone else, I think it's nice just to be able to kind of disengage and take some time away from the screen, as we were talking about before, and just sit back and relax with an actual magazine. Something nice about that.
My final question is about the actual design of the magazine. You mentioned that you didn't want it to look like some of the very polished minimalist food magazines that were out there. You didn't want it to look gendered. What did you want it to look like? Where did you get your inspiration from?
My little brother insisted that the front cover had to be yellow. He said that would be the best choice. So
that's as good a reason as any.
As good a reason as any.
So when
we were trying to decide between a couple of colours, we did end up going with yellow, partly based on that. So
I believe that we're in the process of getting a contract for him as our creative director.
Yeah, okay. I think he's going to replace me. But in terms of kind of where we got the visual style, I think it was very much, I mean, I've worked on different publications before in the past, and I like things to be quite minimalist myself. So it was a bit of a struggle to kind of go against my nature of cutting everything out of the page. But we also wanted to kind of give a bit of space to Helena's photography, and the way that worked ended up quite lending itself to very ragged urban style. Again, I think it's a reaction to what else was out there rather than a direction in itself. You know, we wanted to go against either the clean lines or the kind of the potentially outdated kind of plants and green kind of things everywhere. I swore I was not going to use the colour green in this magazine, and we ended up using it on one article. But, you know, it's
the exception that proves the rule.
Exactly, yeah. I'd like to think so.
I think we deliberately made sure that we didn't have the word vegan on the front as well, because we don't want to alienate anyone who might potentially pick us up and then think it looks cool but see the word vegan and then be like, oh, and put it back down. That was quite important for us.
Thanks very much for coming in. What have we got to look forward to in issue 2? This is the first issue, right?
Yeah, that's our first issue. So we've got a few things in the pipeline. We're going to be exploring a zero waste shop.
We're hoping to kind of feature, obviously, 2 or 3 different kind of businesses around London and the UK. But yeah, it's going to be same as before, hopefully a few more great recipes. One of the things we did in issue 1 that we want to continue was going into actual people's homes and kind of seeing what it's like just to be a normal, regular vegan, you know, and putting that and their lifestyles out in front. So rather than taking on celebrity, trying to kind of make it, you know, normalise it a little bit.
That was editor Helena Murphy and designer Ben McCabe speaking about their magazine, Om Nom. Issue 1 is available now. And in case you're worried, Henry Rhys Sheridan is eating more fresh fruit and vegetables. He needs to. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, do drop a note to Fernando. You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. You've been listening to The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.